It looked just like a brand new suburban development, rising from an unusually desolate part of the Nevada desert, just 60 miles north of Las Vegas, a place known locally as Yucca Flats. That's not the prettiest name for a modern subdivision, but no matter. This one was designed to be destroyed. In the spring of 1955, as the baby boom was in full swing and hundreds of thousands of families all over the country were moving into their dream homes in the suburbs, here at Yucca Flats, the same thing seemed to be going on. Construction crews hefted lumber from flatbed trucks, cement mixers poured concrete foundations, and carpenters, masons, and electricians raised the frames of ranch houses, brick colonials, gas stations, and even a local radio station and a bank. From the distance, through binoculars, you could even make out the forms of prim housewives in frilly aprons in their kitchens, businessmen in new suits ready for the commute to their office, and children playing in their front yards. But this suburb was doomed from the beginning, destined to become a testing ground for what seemed to be imminent nuclear war.
We all know the atomic bomb is very dangerous. No matter where we live, in the city or the country, we must be ready all the time for the atomic bomb. Duck and cover fast, wherever you are. There's no time to look around or wait. Duck and cover. There might not be any grown-ups around when the bomb explodes. Then, you're on your own.
Welcome to Places of Legend, a podcast that digs into places with stories. Stories that are shared in schoolyards, on sidewalks, in urban legends, and even internet memes. Let's call it cultural heritage with a weird twist. It's scary, it's hilarious, it's sometimes grotesque, and almost always hidden. Places of Legend will provide stories that pull back the curtain to reveal the unexpected at various historic sites around the country. I'm Angela Labrador, and with my colleague, Neil Silberman, we hope to turn your ideas about America's places of legend upside down. In this episode, our place of legend is a desolate stretch of arid scrubland in southwestern Nevada, where from 1951 to 1958, the blinding flashes and towering mushroom clouds of atmospheric atom bomb tests rose from the desert floor. It is today a contaminated, radioactive wasteland, but the strange story of an all-American suburb built to be vaporized offers a jarring glimpse at Cold War nuclear madness, and how we have largely forgotten the vivid, visceral feelings of seeing a mushroom cloud rise over American territory. By 1955, Las Vegas had come into its own as America's Sin City. It was the place where Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, and the other crooners, comedians, and hangers-on who would later be known as the Rat Pack typified 50s cool. Meanwhile, Meyer Lansky and his underworld bagmen collected the wages of sin by skillfully skimming casino revenue. Las Vegas had seen its first great period of explosive growth in the years after World War II, when the lure of sex, slots, and round-the-clock action brought some 8 million visitors to the desert oasis. Compared to today's sprawling, towering theme park monuments, Vegas was still a small cluster of hotel casinos spread up and down South Las Vegas Boulevard, locally known as the Strip. Yet by 1955, even though Las Vegas's post-war tourist industry was still booming, new attractions had to be found. The showgirls were still high-kicking, the crooners were still crooning, the big gamblers were still high-rolling, but the United States government stepped in to provide an awesome natural spectacle that could be clearly seen from the rooftops of the newest casino hotels. From 1951 to 1962, 100 or so atmospheric nuclear tests lit up the northern sky and shook the neon-lit pavement as the sight of the rising mushroom clouds in the distance drew new crowds of tourists to the gambling Mecca, which now adopted the nickname Atomic City and added a stylized mushroom cloud to its municipal seal. How did the atom, and later hydrogen bomb, arrive in Las Vegas? And why were the eager tourists so eager and unafraid of radiation to observe it with their own eyes? The truth is that even in 1955, not much was understood of the range and effects of nuclear fallout and the earth-shaking heat, light, and shock waves released with each detonation was a sight that no atomic tourist would ever forget. Just 10 years before, the scientists of the top-secret Manhattan Project were working feverishly in an isolated compound at Los Alamos, New Mexico, to construct the world's first nuclear weapon. At the time, no one knew exactly what an atomic chain reaction could do. Would it work? Would it create a planetary chain reaction that would ignite the entire atmosphere? The scientists at least knew from Einstein's relativity theory that splitting an atom would release an enormous burst of energy. But they could not precisely predict how much energy. Following the first test of a device called the Gadget at the Trinity site, it was clear that an atomic bomb was feasible and had the capacity to devastate an entire city, not the world. Less than a month later, in August 1945, President Harry Truman ordered the dropping of atomic bombs over the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And the sheer scale of the destruction and loss of life produced by these new superweapons brought Imperial Japan to its knees. The war was over, and the atomic age had begun. However, not even the scientists at Los Alamos were aware of the long-term effects of atomic explosions, or whether the technology should even be used again. In the following summer, Japan was under American occupation, and the long World War was finally over. The U.S. tested three more atomic bombs in the Marshall Islands over an isolated atoll called Bikini. In those tests, they sunk and irradiated dozens of vessels that had been captured from the Japanese Navy. Unfortunately, they unknowingly irradiated the VIPs and sailors who witnessed the blasts in the process. Despite the emerging evidence of some kind of mysterious radiation sickness, the atmospheric tests went on. The iconic image of the gigantic mushroom cloud rising over the turquoise waters of the Pacific became a symbol of the power of modern science. The word atomic itself became a synonym for the new age that was dawning, and for anything considered powerful and new. A French swimsuit designer named his daring two-piece creation the Bikini after the Pacific Test. And all across America, atomic-themed car washes, pizza shops, diners, and motels sprung up, associating their various offerings with America's modern technological edge. The atomic bomb was not just another weapon. It fundamentally changed the paradigm of destruction from a one-time ignition of an explosive substance to a wild subatomic chain reaction that could get out of control. America's atomic monopoly gave it a decisive edge in the dawning Cold War. But America's edge soon started to narrow. In 1949, the Soviet Union tested its first atomic device at a remote site in Kazakhstan, vaporizing the buildings at Ground Zero and incinerating the animals they had brought there for the radioactivity tests. The atomic race was officially on, with both the United States and the Soviet Union determined to use any means available to gain the relative, if only temporary, military advantage toward a seemingly inevitable atomic war. From 1951 to 1961, the main focus of America's nuclear testing program, consisting of 100 atmospheric detonations, took place in the desolate Nevada test site, just 60 miles over the mountain ridge, northwest of the Las Vegas Strip. The thousands of atomic soldiers who were brought to Nevada to manage the test preparations and monitor the effects were housed in the Las Vegas suburbs and were warmly welcomed on brightly lit casino marquees. Danger from the A-bomb explosion so close to a population center? Forget about it. No worries. The government assured the public that radiation from nuclear blasts would be concentrated almost entirely at Ground Zero, and that the spectacular, irradiated mushroom clouds would quickly disperse in the wind. At worst, the citizens in Las Vegas could wash away the radiation in a hot shower as easily as desert dust. The flash and devastation were the only things that seemed to matter. The atomic bomb and the vastly more powerful hydrogen bomb that was successfully tested at the Nevada test site in November 1952 were beginning to be seen as effective battlefield weapons in any future confrontation with another superpower. And when the Soviets tested their own hydrogen bomb in the following year, the decisive American edge was lost. The strategic challenge became the survivability of the superpowers' civilian populations, if and when nuclear war broke out. For baby boomers and their parents, the triangular red, white, and blue civil defense symbols, yellow signs pointing the way to public shelters, and the duck and cover crouch under the desk drills became part of everyday life. The atomic soldiers of the Nevada test site were preoccupied with the power and destruction wrought by various bombs designed to maintain American nuclear superiority. Meanwhile, the officials of the Civil Defense Agency, which was created by President Truman in 1950, concentrated all their energies on the home front. Public service TV commercials featuring the cute antics of Bert the Turtle showed the kids how to survive.
Dum dum, deedle dum dum. Deedle-dum-dum, deedle-dum-dum. There was a turtle by the name of Bert, and Bert the turtle was very alert. When danger threatened him, he never got hurt. He knew just what to do. He'd duck and cover, duck and cover.
He did what we all must learn to do.
You
and you
and you
and you.
And cover.
But there was a problem that the civil defense establishment knew it had to solve. The American population on the home front was no longer crowded in cities or widely spread across farmland. The explosive growth of the suburbs had to be taken into account. Real estate developers across the country were creating massive subdivisions of ranch houses, two-story colonials, neighborhood schools, and shopping centers. And increasingly, it was in these places where the American civilian population lived. The bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki were dropped on closely packed urban centers. How would the Leavitt towns and Orange counties of America fare? Thus was conceived one of the most bizarre military experiments ever attempted on American soil. The goal was to recreate a 1950s suburb, drop an atom bomb on it, and see who or even what would survive. Nuclear physicists were not central to the planning of what came to be enigmatically called Operation Q, that's C-U-E. The main participants were experienced suburban developers, construction crews, retail experts and window dressers from the JCPenney department stores, and field technicians of various public utilities. Through the spring of 1955, while Walt Disney was building the happiest place on Earth at Disneyland in Anaheim, the work crews in nearby southern Nevada were busily constructing a different kind of artificial environment, a place they optimistically called Survival Town. For that was the object, to see what kinds of suburban building materials, makeshift shelters, and public infrastructure would survive a nuclear strike. The very same firms who were building America's suburbs contributed their know-how to make the test as realistic as possible. Utility poles, power lines, and electrical substations were constructed by the Edison Institute, a trade organization of private utilities. Gas lines and propane tanks were installed by the Natural Gas Association. And five different house models were built by the construction crews of large suburban development contractors. One-story wooden ranch houses, two-story brick colonials with a full basement, cinder block structures representing stores and drive-ins, prefabricated concrete buildings, and two-story wooden frame houses that were specially reinforced. This catalog of suburban architecture was built in two clusters, one close to ground zero and another about a mile away. Each house was fully furnished with the latest appliances, including gleaming new kitchen stoves, and pantries and refrigerators were filled with supermarket food. And for the inhabitants of Survival Town, the JCPenney Company provided dozens of store mannequins, each dressed in the latest ready-to-wear fashions and carefully posed in the front yards or seated on sofas or at kitchen tables donated by the American Furniture Association. Finally, in the pre-dawn hours of May 5, 1955, the embodiments of American consumer society were put to the test.
On Media Hill, television equipment was ready to bring the test into homes from coast to coast. Reporters, commentators, military and civil defense observers all had a purpose, to study the results of this explosion. At a position a mile forward from Media Hill, the Civil Defense Field Exercise Group had assembled with their equipment. A small group of civil defense volunteers were to occupy a trench relatively close to ground zero. On Media Hill, where I remain, there was hot coffee, last-minute briefings, and more waiting. But it seemed no time at all before the loudspeaker warned,
H-1 minute. Put on your goggles. Observers without goggles must face away from the blast.
On the silent desert, the test objects waited.
H-10 seconds. 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Just 24 hours after the 30-megaton explosion, it was thought safe enough for the test crews to enter the area around Ground Zero and examine the remains. What they found was extensive devastation, but in the later newsreels for public consumption, the Civil Defense Agency assured the American people that as far as nuclear survival was concerned, the glass was half full. The cinder block structures survived without much damage. Reinforced bathroom shelters offered some degree of protection. The natural gas tanks survived undamaged, and even the connections were still intact. A simulated radio station was quickly on the air again, and although the power lines and electrical grid suffered some damage, the public was reassured that they could be quickly repaired. And the mannequins standing out in the open suffered nothing more serious than faded colors on their dresses and suits. Thus, the test of Survival Town was deemed a great success, and as the test crews broke for lunch to enjoy the food that had been spread on open tables, the Civil Defense Agency concluded that we had learned many lessons for the survival of our homes, our families, and our nation in the nuclear age. The lesson was taught all over the country in highly visible and unknowingly dangerous ways. The JCPenney Company, not wanting to pass up an opportunity for good publicity, or for that matter, let a good mannequin go to waste, quickly reclaimed all the intact inhabitants of Survival Town and displayed them at the JCPenney store in Las Vegas. And the Balin Construction Company of Columbus, Ohio, which had constructed a number of the Survival Town homes, were so pleased with the sturdiness of their buildings that they displayed one of them at the 1955 Nebraska State Fair. Visitors to the exhibit were invited to step into the building and take away civil defense pamphlets free of charge. For several years, the city of Las Vegas continued to capitalize on the atomic spectacles that went on until 1962. The Chamber of Commerce distributed schedules listing the detonation times of upcoming tests. And since they mostly took place in the pre-dawn hours, casinos with a good view to the northwest sponsored all-night bomb-watching parties and an annual Miss Atomic Bomb pageant. At the time of the Survival Town test, and for several years afterward, the sheer spectacle of the flash and rising mushroom cloud was good for business in Las Vegas, and indeed across the country. The providers of the furniture and appliances for the test houses proudly publicized their involvement, and they joined the civil defense in insisting that survival in a nuclear war was not only a possibility, but a responsibility for Americans everywhere. In fact, the lessons of Operation Q were adopted in the design of commercially available fallout shelters that responsible homeowners had dug into their backyards in the following years. But a dark secret lay in the ruins of Survival Town that foreboded not survival, but suffering and ultimately doom. The civilian observers, and even more so the atomic soldiers who roamed over the newly irradiated detonation sites, showed significantly higher incidence of cancer and had a much higher risk of producing children with birth defects. A 1997 report by the National Cancer Institute determined that the atmospheric tests at the Nevada test site spread dangerous levels of radioactive iodine-131 across a large area of the United States, enough to cause 10 to 75,000 additional cases of thyroid cancer in four specific years of testing. Survival from a nuclear exchange was not as easy or as effective as so many in the defense establishment had claimed. In 1963, the United States, United Kingdom, and Soviet Union agreed to the Limited Test Ban Treaty. This watershed treaty recognized that the almost 20 years of above-ground nuclear explosions had seriously contaminated the atmosphere and could not continue. From 1963 until 1992, when underground nuclear detonations finally ended, the Nevada test site lost much of its public appeal. No more all-night atom bomb parties. No more beauty queens with elaborate mushroom cloud costumes. All that remained was a pockmarked expanse of scrubland, with the ruins of towers from which the bombs were detonated, and the charred and crumbling ruins of survival town houses, silently mocking the suggestion that nuclear weapons were like any other weapon of war. Somehow, the flashes and mushroom clouds that rose above the Nevada test site have become caricatures of the Cold War. The devastation they wrought on the land and on the health and security of the public have passed from direct experience into second, third, and fourth-hand memory. And like almost every other place of history turned legend, Survival Town has become a tourist attraction of sorts. Monthly tours from the National Atomic Testing Museum in Las Vegas take visitors to see the remains of the test site, with the ruins of Survival Town saved as a highlight at the end of the tour. Today, nuclear weapons have proliferated to the Middle East, India, China, and North Korea with the threat of atmospheric testing and the capacity to deliver thermonuclear weapons with intercontinental ballistic missiles, an almost certain trigger for war. This time, the dangers to the atmosphere and far-flung civilian populations will not be unknown or concealed by false assurances of survival. Nuclear weapons are terrifying sabers to rattle. In today's tense and uncertain time of post-Cold War tribalism, nuclear devices continue to proliferate among rogue states and terrorist movements who have the money and contacts to acquire them. Nuclear confrontation, it seems, is no longer a last resort, but a continuing global threat. Can we be sure that the deadly effects of even the relatively small nuclear devices, like those tested within viewing distance of Las Vegas, can be averted in our increasingly nuclearized world?
We all know the atomic bomb is very dangerous.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Places of Legend, a podcast in which we explore historic places where the forgotten and unexpected meeting of past and present offers a new kind of heritage experience. We invite you to visit our website at placesoflegend.com to learn more about these places and contribute some legendary stories and memories of your own. In our next episode, we will travel to Boston, Massachusetts, to search among the monuments of colonial America and the Revolution for clues to one of the weirdest, stickiest, and nastiest industrial accidents in early 20th century America, the day that the North End was inundated and nearly 200 people were injured or suffocated in a sickeningly sweet tsunami that has come to be known as the Great Molasses Flood. Until then, thanks for listening, and we look forward to joining you in discovering more places of legend.
We must be ready all the time for the atomic bomb.
And powder.
Sundays, holidays, vacation time, if the atom bomb explodes, duck and cover fast, wherever you are. There's no time to look around or wait. That flash means act fast.